Good morning. I'm Donna Quinn. And for the next half hour, I hope you will be listening to Talk of Our Towns. Today, my guest is supposed to be Bill Carter, and we are having a little issue with our equipment. We're supposed to be having a phone interview with him, and we're working on that right now to see if we can connect with him. In the meantime, I'll go ahead and explain a little bit about what this program is hopefully going to be about today. And I'll start with a question. What do houses, cars, planes, computers, and cell phones have in common? We're going to find that out from my guest today, hopefully. Bill Carter is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, photographer, and journalist. He has worked as a commercial fisherman in Alaska, a news cameraman, an adobe bricklayer. He's also the director of the documentary film Miss Sarajevo, with Bono. He's the author of the books Red Summer and Fools Rush In, and his articles have been published in such publications as Rolling Stone, Outside, Men's Journal, and Spin. He's also recently written a blog for the Huffington Post and was just interviewed by the Daily Beast about his latest book, Boom, Bust, Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World. Bill will be in Astoria presenting at the Fisher Poets Gathering in Astoria at Clemente's Restaurant on Friday, February 22nd. And we're going to explain why he's doing that. Why is Bill coming to Fisher Poets Gathering? He's actually been here a couple of years before, involved because he was a commercial fisherman in Alaska. And we are supposed to be speaking with him from his home in Flagstaff, Arizona today. And Terry's still working on that. Bill is also going to be on a panel at the Columbia River Maritime Museum on Saturday. And he will explain to us the why copper is the metal that runs the world. And I have read all of Bill's books in the past. I loved Miss Sarajevo, Red Summer, and Fools Rush In. They're highly acclaimed books, did very well. And this latest book, Boom, Bust, Boom, about copper, I must confess, when I got the book, I thought, oh, this is probably going to be boring. And it is not boring. It is fascinating. I could not put it down, in fact. And that's because Bill is an investigative journalist and a really a curious person who wants to understand why does copper have what is the history, the legacy of it, who runs it, and why we don't know that much about it, because it affects all of us in the world today. How are we doing, Terry? Do you think we might be able to get him on the phone?
Trying.
All right. We're still working on it. So the reason that I feel this book is so powerful and that everyone should read it, and it will be for sale at Fisher Poets Gathering in the Gear Shack. Fisher Poets Gathering is starts on Friday, February 22nd. And this book explains how copper affects all of us. All of us. We all use copper. So, and why the proposed pebble mine in Alaska is not the right place for a copper mine. It is something that would destroy the salmon fishery, the world's healthiest salmon fishery in the world. And that's a connection. And I'm continuing to talk because Terry's continuing to try to work with the equipment so that we can have Bill on the program. I would ask all of you to try to not miss him when he is here in Astoria next weekend. The story starts out with, and I think what I might do, since we're not having success right now, is just read a little bit of the first chapter to explain how Bill got involved in writing this book, Boom, Bust, Boom, which is a Simon Schuster release, and it's been getting a lot of praise. So we'll start out with chapter one, which is Tainted Vegetables. And he starts off with a little comment by Tom Waits. I like my town with a little drop of poison. Every spring, I plant a garden. So, Terry, we're not going to be able to talk with him. All right, so we aren't going to be able to reach Bill today, and I'm so sorry because he's very articulate, and I don't know, perhaps we'll be able to do something with him next week. But since we now have this program, you're listening, we're on the air, we're just going to punt. We're just going to do what we can. And so I'm going to read a little bit from his book for you all. So chapter one, Tainted Vegetables. Every spring, I plant a garden, a small but noble pursuit. Small in the sense that there are many more important items on the daily calendars of our lives, but noble because each step of self-sustainability has a lovely feeling of beating the ever-invasive food industry at its own game. In my line of work, I travel a lot, sometimes to places where food is measured by cups of rice a week, and water is delivered to homes by 10-year-olds who have walked 5 miles through desolation to get to a well. Planting a garden is a way of keeping the harsh realities of the world at bay. It seems a sane practice in a world hell-bent on destroying itself. When home, I try to talk to the plants every day. I grew up on a farm, so speaking to budding pomegranates seems natural to me, sometimes more so than speaking to my neighbor. Peaches and apricots are good listeners, too. I go to them for comfort. I trust the plants, and the seeds, although invisible, give great solace as they incubate in the ground. This particular spring carries special meaning for me. My wife is pregnant with our second daughter, and our 2-year-old is eager to take on the chores of watering and helping her dad with the daily garden duties. My plan is to create a large vegetable garden in a backyard area we have never used. It is situated between 2 tall trees, perfect for morning and afternoon sun, but shaded during midday. After 2 full weekends of digging, raking, and trips to the hardware store, I complete a drip irrigation system. My daughter and I spend a Sunday morning planting squash, tomatoes, lettuce, spring onions, jalapenos, green peppers, and several herbs, including basil, thyme, and chives. Each morning for weeks thereafter, I wake with the sun to see how much the garden has grown overnight. In the beginning, the progress is slow, but soon the vegetables burst through the thin layer of dirt and begin to morph into yellow, red, and green. After 6 weeks of daily attention, I collect my first batch of spring lettuce. I coddle each leaf as I wash it in the sink. Finally, I prepare a salad for dinner. My wife won't eat the lettuce or any other item from the garden. She's not a food snob, but she is careful what she eats because of the baby that grows inside her. I argue that the food is as organic as we can find. She replies that she doesn't trust the dirt. She has a point. We live in Bisbee, Arizona, a small hamlet couched in the Mule Mountains, a mile above sea level. Bisbee is a dormant mining town located 8 miles from the Mexican border as the crow flies. The copper mine closed down more than 30 years ago, but the effects of its existence remain. Mine shafts pockmark the hillsides, and sulfuric acid runoff stains the cliffs a burnt orange. Giant headframes dot the horizon, reminders of the elevators, the size of houses that used to carry men 1,000 feet below the surface. And then there is the open pit, a large crater on the edge of town where all the water from our torrential monsoon rains pours off the mountains into this mile-long giant bathtub. My wife and I met in Bisbee not long after we both moved here in 2000, mostly to get away from anything resembling suburbia. As I've passed through the decades, I realize I have a few steadfast requirements for what I call quality of life. Most important is not driving in traffic. At all. I need to walk out my front door to a good hiking trail. I also like the ability to barter, if money is short, for any vital necessity. In Bisbee, I've always been able to trade one of my books for a meal, a poker buy-in, or a bottle of wine, or all three. Money is required here, but bartering is accepted. In Bisbee, no two houses are quite alike. In fact, they are spectacularly different, reflecting the individual owners who built them most more than 100 years ago. Several streets are so narrow that driving down them requires bending the mirror inward to avoid clipping it off. Gas lines run exposed up stairways, occasionally doubling as railings. Each homeowner must adapt to the nuances of his or her home, and no manual exists to help with repairs. Local plumbers and electricians have to throw their training out the window, because no job in town resembles that of a modern-day house. Bisbee is no ordinary mining town. In its heyday, it was one of the largest copper mines in the United States. Phelps Dodge, then the owners of the mine, and once the political and economic alpha force of Arizona that owned almost every large copper mine in the state, took more than $8 billion in copper from this place. You don't take that much from the earth without leaving a scar or two. In 2007, Freeport-McMoRan bought the Bisbee mining operation, and everything else Phelps Dodge had owned in Arizona and throughout the world for $25 billion, including mines in Africa and Chile. Freeport now owns a majority of the land to the north and south of Bisbee. They own the dormant mine. They own the 2,700 miles of mining tunnels that run beneath the town. They own some parcels of the mountains, sections of the outlying desert, and many buildings in town. Even though they don't own most of the homes, at times it feels like the only things they don't own or control are the people and the sky. And now Terry's trying once again to connect us with author and filmmaker Bill Carter. He now lives in Flagstaff, Arizona. And you can see from what I've read in the beginning, it certainly is not boring because it starts out with what happened in his own yard that made him interested in copper, since that had been what had been happening in Bisbee. And I think I'm going to move now to the section of the book which talks about Pebble Mine. Throughout this book, Bill researches mines throughout the world, ties it to the economy here in the United States and worldwide. And he also, it's just amazing how he has woven this in. I truly had no idea how powerful copper was and is in the world today. So now I'm going to move to Chapter 8, Pebble Mine. And Terry, it's not going to work, right? Okay, we're so sorry. Technology sometimes does not work. And apologies to Bill Carter. And maybe, why don't you call Bill? Maybe he can listen to this on his on the web or something. I mean, hopefully. Anyway, so here we are. We're going to read some of Bill's book. Okay. And you have an opportunity to see Bill Carter at Fisher Poets Gathering on Friday, February 22nd at Clemente's Restaurant. There will be other Fisher Poets there, and they will be learning more about the Pebble Mine. So now I'm going to move to Chapter 8, which is about Pebble Mine. And there's a quote from Stuart Udall, the former Secretary of the Interior for John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. "Mining is like a search and destroy mission. I'm on the way to the airport. I'm flying to Alaska, where I have worked as a commercial fisherman every summer for the past several years. But I'm not going there to fish this time. I'm going because there is talk of developing one of the world's biggest copper and gold mines near the watershed at Bristol Bay, which is home to the world's largest sockeye salmon run, with almost 40 million fish returning every summer. I'm familiar with many people fighting against the potential mining operation, and I'm on my way to hear firsthand what would happen if the mine opens." One of the things I also want to mention about Bill, is he listening to the program?
Yes, he is. So you can say hello to
him. Oh, hi, Bill.
He can't say hello to us.
He can't say hello back to us. All right. Bill, thank you so much for standing by this morning. I'm so terribly sorry that our technology failed us here. I've been reading a little bit of your book. I started a little bit with how you became interested in copper when you were planning your garden in Bisbee, and now I've moved to Pebble Mine. One of the things I think is so brilliant about the book is that you do try to keep an open mind about a lot of things, because to be curious and to have the meetings, for you to have gotten to meet with all of these powerful, you know, copper moguls and people who run this, is phenomenal. I think that's because you did not come with a prejudiced mind. You came saying, I want to understand this, I want to know. Because obviously, we're all hypocrites, we all use copper. And that's something that you talk about in the book, you know, that we do have to have copper mines. And but where they are and how they are operated is an issue. So sorry, Bill, I'm going to continue on. I'm going to read a little bit about from the Pebble Mine chapter, since that directly connects with Fisher Poets Gathering, which is happening the weekend after this here in Astoria, Oregon. So we've just read that the largest sockeye salmon run, healthiest, is in Bristol Bay, with almost 40 million fish returning every summer. I'm familiar with many people fighting against a potential mining operation, and I'm on my way to hear firsthand what would happen if the mine opens. Driving toward the airport, I glance down at the coins on my passenger seat. I remember hearing somewhere that pennies contain almost no copper. In fact, they are 97% zinc, and only copper-coated, whereas quarters are almost all copper. And I just want to say that throughout the book, there are all of these amazing facts that you never knew, and I just found that fascinating. In the last several months, my mind has become consumed by what copper is. and I find even the smallest details fascinating. Every coin has copper in it. Every house has, on average, 400 pounds of copper pipe and wiring. Since 1963, it's estimated that more than 30 billion feet, or 5.5 million miles of copper plumbing, have been installed in the United States. Every 747 jet airliner has 135 miles of copper wire, weighing 9,000 pounds. The Statue of Liberty weighs in at 100 tons of copper. A Triton-class nuclear submarine uses 200,000 pounds of copper. And recently I found out that there is 3,300 pounds of copper in the radiator of the Caterpillar 797, the mining trucks in Morenci. Over the years, there have been attempts to replace copper as the main electrical wire in homes, but so far nothing can beat copper's low price and high conductivity. In the 1970s, due to a spike in the price, there was a move to substitute aluminum for copper. That adventure nosedived after a few houses burned down when the aluminum caught fire while conducting electricity. Of all the minerals that fuel our current way of life, copper is the heavyweight. It alone, not gold, silver, zinc, cobalt, or any other mineral, is most responsible for creating what we like to call civilization. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talk of Our Towns. I'm your host, Donna Quinn. Today, my guest was to be Bill Carter. He is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, photographer, and journalist. He was the director of the documentary film Miss Sarajevo, based on his book. He wrote Red Summer and Fools Rush In, all incredible books. He's written a blog for the Huffington Post. You can go to Bill's website, and that will take you to some other fascinating articles to read. And his website is www.billcarter.cc. Bill's latest book from Simon Schuster just came out. It's Boom, Bust, Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World. And Bill is coming from his home in Flagstaff, Arizona, to Fisher Poets Gathering on Friday, February 22nd. He'll be giving a presentation at Clemente's Restaurant, in Astoria. And then he will be on a panel the next day at the Columbia River Maritime Museum. And the connection between copper and Fisher Poets Gathering is significant because there is a proposed mine called the Pebble Mine in Alaska. And right now, since unfortunately our technology failed us today, we are I have Bill's book with me here in the studio. He was kind enough to send it to me. It's and I just really have not been able to put it down. And so now we're reading about the his journey to Alaska to research how the local people feel about Pebble Mine, to take a tour, to talk to mining executives there. I veer north toward Tombstone, home of the daily OK Corral gunfight, bison burgers, and lots of T-shirt shops. Once a genuine silver mining town, Tombstone shut down for all practical purposes by the end of the 1890s when the mines flooded. Since then, Tombstone has slipped into role-playing what it used to be. Men dress as cowboys with fake guns and walk the streets waiting for the next gunfight show to begin. Women prance around town in corsets and low-cut dresses. Like clockwork, a gunfight happens around high noon. No one dies, and the tourists take photos, and the actors dust themselves off and get ready for the 3 o'clock show. The airport is still an hour away. As I drive, I see the country around me differently, perhaps for the first time. 100 years ago, small mines dotted the landscape. Today, they are all still there, hidden off the trails, some surrounded by wire, some open shafts that fall 200 feet into darkness. And then he continues on driving through the desert. He gets to the airport, and now let's have him land in Alaska. Excuse me. Finally, I get to the airport, get on a plane, and 12 hours later, land in Dillingham, Alaska. I walk through the one-room terminal to the payphone. I call the name penciled into my tattered notebook. A woman asks, "Who are you?" I tell her I got her number from a friend in Naknek. Sorry, Bill. Who knows her husband, and that I was supposed to spend the night at their home. "He's down at the nets, but I'll come get you in 10 minutes. Of course, she didn't question my intentions. Why would she? In the Alaska bush, a mutual friend is a key to the front door. I ask how I will recognize her. "I have red hair and I'm fat. she says with a laugh that reminds me I'm back in the land where no one cares what you look like. Only if you can hack out an existence in a place that tries very hard to push people away. In a few moments, a woman with flaming red hair wearing sweatpants and rain boots enters the terminal. There are several young fishermen staggering about, greenhorns lost in their first moments of getting ready to do one of the hardest jobs on earth. She walks straight toward me. I'm Ginger, Terry's wife. Come on, then. Let's get out of this dance hall, shall we? At home, Terry Hofferly, her husband, and the man I am meant to meet, hovers at the kitchen counter with a king salmon, half as tall as himself and easily weighing 50 pounds. Biggest one I can remember, he yells at his wife. Not a mean kind of yelling, but the kind that develops over years as people lose their hearing. He lays the monster on the counter and slowly begins to fillet the meat, being careful not to nick the stomach. It is a female, and she's carrying thousands of eggs, which Terry tenderly puts into a basket. He will later soak them in brine and use them for trading with natives. You got boots? He asks me. I do, I reply. Well, let's go. Got to bring in the net a bit. It's a holdover tide, meaning the ebb tide will be weak, allowing fish to continue to push upriver against the current and into the hundreds of nets put out by locals. We drive past the headquarters of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and the Kanakanak Hospital. A few miles later, we turn onto a dirt road. The rain begins, as it always does in Alaska, and we park next to a thicket of alders. Hey, bear, hey, bear, hey, bear, we're coming to get the hell out of here, we're coming, Terry screams at the top of his lungs. He's pounding his fist on the truck hood. The rain falls harder now, but we're both veterans of Alaska, and so we act like we're enjoying a warm day in Puerto Rico, as opposed to a freezing afternoon in Bristol Bay. Walking near a river during salmon season in Alaska causes an impending feeling of a large predator waiting, lurking, and stalking you. The grizzly bear may not attack this time, but you never know about the next time, and your eyes, ears, and each and every part of your body are suddenly awake and alert. You're not what it wants, but there's a chance you may find yourself between the bear and the salmon-thick stream bed. Still yelling, we reach the river and quickly begin to heave Terry's net up toward shore, wrapping the excess rope around a series of stakes that hold the net in place as the tides rip back and forth. Here's my question, Terry begins unprompted. Why would you risk a known sustainable resource for one that will only last 50 years? And if there's a bad accident at the mine, it may kill the fish. Why risk a resource we already have with absolute certainty? He asks, pointing toward the river. These salmon have been feeding in this region and around the world for thousands of years, and we've been making money from them for more than 100. That could go on for hundreds of years unless someone screws up and puts a bunch of toxins in the water. Terry is lamenting about Pebble Mine. The non-existent mine is on the lips of everyone who lives within 200 miles. There are signs in yards, bumper stickers on trucks. Commercial boats have no pebble painted on the side. The issue divides homes, families, and marriages. One man I meet doesn't speak to his father-in-law anymore because they disagree on the mining issue. The battles are happening in 30-odd villages spread out over 90,000 square miles. All this over a mine, which, if built, won't be in production until 2015 or later. But if built, it will be the largest source of copper in North America. The deposits are truly staggering. The estimates indicate approximately 80 billion pounds of copper, 100 million ounces of gold, and 5.6 million of molybdenum. Calculated at today's market rates, the deposit comes out to be worth anywhere between 300 and 500 billion over the 75-year lifespan of the mine. I know it's a lot of money, but the vast majority of that money will go to shareholders in other countries, people who'll never know or care that they killed a way of life for us and our salmon, our planet, says Terry as we heave the net further up the shore. I stare out toward the flat gray horizon of Bristol Bay, a one-of-a-kind fishery that is home to half the world's known salmon runs. The sockeye run is worth upward of $400 million each year to the local economies through fish tax, fishermen's wages, and secondary incomes from shipping fish, canning fish, and the many other ways fish are brought to market. Stretched out over the life of the mine, this equals around $22 billion over 75 years. This is a lot of money either way. A fundamental truth is that the big money tends to win the fight. A second truth of equal value and importance is that sometimes the underdogs win. And when they do, life feels a bit sweeter. And we just have a few minutes left. And so I think that at this point, I'll probably stop reading from Bill's book, Boom, Bust, Boom. But let me just read the a little bit of the book jacket for you all, too. Actually, on the back, there are a few quotes here, which are pretty terrific. Advance praise for Boom, Bust, Boom. Bill Carter has extracted something that remains all but unnoticed by most people, copper, and told an incredible story about this amazing metal. Boom, Bust, Boom is the best sort of journalism, beautifully written, rich in detail, and impossible to ignore. I particularly loved how Carter wove a personal story into a topic of global scope. I know as a writer how hard that is excuse me, to pull off. And as a reader, I'm always amazed when someone does. It's a superb book. That's Sebastian Junger. And then we have from Jim Harrison, Bill Carter's new book is utterly engaging. I want to use the words fabulous and hearty. We often think we know the world, but then we read a book that tells us we didn't. Carter is a determined investigative journalist and shows the grave dangers the copper industry carelessly exposes us to. A necessary read for thinking Americans. That's from Jim Harrison. And then from Chris Bowden, the author of a well-respected book, Copper is the Curse of the Southwest. Bill Carter's blazing book takes us to the crime scene, where our lust for things murders the earth. Time to kill the cell phone, leave Twitter to the twits, and listen up. What I find so interesting, though, is, again, that Bill is not a rabid true believer of any stripe that I find. He's a very thoughtful, intelligent journalist. He makes the point that we all are hypocrites. We all use copper. So, of course, we're going to continue to need that metal. However, there are places in the world where copper should not be mined. And the proposed pebble mine in Alaska is one of those. So I urge all of you to come to check out Bill's website, which is www.billcarter.cc. You can order the book at our local bookstores, Boom, Bust, Boom. You can also purchase it at Fisher Poets Gathering at the Gear Shack the weekend after this. And I want to thank Terry Wilson.
I want to compliment you. You just pulled off something that not very many people can do.
Well,
you filled for a half an hour.
I don't know. I
and
had Bill's
Bill
book.
Is listening to us, and I think, Bill, you must agree with me. She did an upstanding job.
No, Bill, I so apologize, and I'm sorry I love this book. I'm so grateful that you sent it to me, and I'm so glad I brought it with me to the studio today. And so anyway, Bill, thank you so much. We will look forward to seeing you here the week after next, and we'll be talking more about this over the next 10 days before Fisher Poets Gathering. Thanks again for writing such an important book. Terry Wilson, thank you for doing what you can, and you always do. You're still our engineer extraordinaire, and I want to express my gratitude to local talented banjo instructor Michael Bruin for his original theme music for this program. Until next week, find a moment for yourself today. Take a deep breath. With gratitude for all the good things in your life, focus on those good things, on expanding them, on feeling good, and then give yourself a loving and compassionate hug or a pat on the back for being uniquely you, for doing the best you can, and for being here now in this moment, the only moment which exists, on the amazing planet we call Earth.